The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 331 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off, here for Sunday, June 8th, 2014. I am the Solid Monster. The Shield is no more. Very sad. I've been playing Say It Isn't So by Hall & Oates nonstop ever since the big turn on Monday night. Payback last Sunday had some pretty big shoes to fill coming off the NXT TakeOver show. We'll talk about whether or not they managed to do that. Some raw thoughts on a show that really was not very good, although it's the greatest show in the world compared to Impact last Thursday. I got a lot to say about TNA this week. So after missing the show last week and quitting on it halfway through the week before that, got a lot of thoughts on that. So we'll get into it here in just a second. Let me just remind everybody that if you want to use a hashtag for the show on Twitter, Facebook, since it's been so long and I haven't really established one, the official hashtag for the Sound Off is Solomonster. It's very simple. So if you want to have any sort of discussion related to the show with other people, if you're posting in response to the latest episode and you're big on hashtags, the one to use is simply hashtag Solomonster. So just keep that in mind. Also, I want to thank Brandon the Galactical Garrel for making a PayPal donation to the show this week. He was the only one. So I'm going to keep on busting my ass for you guys every single week, but please consider making a PayPal donation to the show. You can do so on thesolomonster.com. The donation box is on the right-hand side, so please consider doing that. Again, $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. You can pretty much give whatever you want to. The show keeps rolling on, you know, regardless. I give it my all every single weekend, but please consider doing that. And also, you can support the show by signing up for a free Audible trial. Audible.com has a free 30-day trial. You use our custom URL, which is audibletrial.com/solomonster, and sign up from there. That helps the show out. You get to sample the service for a month for free, no obligation, and you get a free audiobook as part of your sign-up, whether you stick with it or not. It's a great service. They've got over 100,000 books. If you travel, if you go to the gym, if you like listening to audiobooks, Audible is the number one service, and you can use audibletrial.com/solomonster to help out the Sound Off. So thank you to those who have done that in the last couple of weeks. I appreciate it. Payback was in Chicago last Sunday. It was a sellout, but there were people there who said a good 10% of the seats were empty. And it was probably people who bought tickets, but then when the Blackhawks went to the playoffs, and it was Game 7 last Sunday, which couldn't be worse for WWE, those people just ate whatever they paid for their tickets and they watched the hockey game instead. Which I can believe. You know, they love their hockey in Chicago. Or they did, anyway. The Blackhawks lost. And if it's any consolation to those fans in Chicago, the Rangers are now in a 2-0 hole against the Kings, and they're pretty much on the verge of the same fate. We'll see what happens with them. Main event was Evolution against The Shield, no holes barred elimination match. Again, two stipulations that kind of contradict one another. And sure enough, Batista was the first one eliminated, but he stuck around. He beat up some members of The Shield. It was a really good match. You know, these two teams, they work well together. They had two back-to-back excellent pay-per-view matches, a lot of good action. And in the end, The Shield, clean sweep. Not one of them eliminated. They eliminated Batista, Randy Orton, and they finished off with Triple H. They picked off each member of Evolution, which made The Shield look stronger. Didn't really mean much the next night on Raw, nor did it make much sense. But it was a great match, and it was also the birth of Blutista, which was quite the sight when Evolution comes walking out, donning all black, and there's Batista in his laser blue outfit. He certainly does what he wants to. He marches to his own drummer. You gotta respect that. But that was one of the big stories of the night. Blutista was trending on Twitter for hours after that. John Cena and Bray Wyatt had a last man standing match, which was quite the turnaround from their steel cage match at Extreme Rules. The cage match at Extreme Rules was awful. It was terrible. It turned me off this whole feud. This match was excellent. It was a great match. I enjoyed it. It was a lot of gimmicks. There was a lot of interference. The Wyatt family interfered. The Usos interfered. But you know what, though? What annoyed me about the cage match, because they still promote cage matches as, well, we're keeping people outside the cage, and they're so full of shit every time they say that. So we had Harper and Rowan constantly trying to get inside the cage, and it just pissed me off. Here, there was no debate about what was going to happen here. It was basically a no-holds-barred match. Anything goes. You knew that the Wyatts were going to get involved. You knew the Usos were probably going to be involved, and they were. And in some ways, they made the match better. Some people may not like that. They may think, well, how could it be a great match if they needed the four other guys to, you know, help them along here? It's part of the package. You know, when you look at the match overall, there was a lot of action that happened at ringside with the Wyatts and the Usos. I think at one point, Luke Harper suplexed one of the Usos from the top rope out to the floor through a table. Just crazy mayhem in this match. And, yeah, they did one of their typical WWE last man standing John Cena match finishes. He didn't duct tape the guy's legs together this time, but he gave him an attitude adjustment through a box somewhere back by the staging area. Then he pushed like another giant box on top of it, and Bray Wyatt was buried. Literally. He was literally buried underneath this giant box. And he could not respond to the 10 count, so John Cena gets the win. I called it. I told you people John Cena was winning. I didn't think there was really much debate about it. You know, he won the first match. He lost the second match. But he didn't really lose the second match. You know, a kid showed up in a cloak. It scared the hell out of John Cena because he doesn't want to have kids of his own or whatever the hell his reason was for being afraid of a little kid outside the cage. And he was going to win the rubber match. They weren't going to beat John Cena twice back-to-back on pay-per-view. Just wasn't going to happen. It's like when Cena lost to The Rock at WrestleMania the first time. He came back the next month. He beat Brock Lesnar. Brock's first match. They're not going to beat Cena like that on back-to-back pay-per-views. They're just not going to do it. So Cena wins. This feud is over. Bray Wyatt can move on to other things now. You know, is he stronger coming out of this feud? I don't know. I guess we'll find out. He's still over. The people still like him. It didn't seem to hurt him too much. And he had a great match. But I don't necessarily think just by working with John Cena that it did a world of good for the guy. It'll be a lot better for him, I think, to move on to somebody else now. They also had a segment with Stephanie. Daniel Bryan coming out. Is he going to forfeit the title? Is Brie Bella going to be fired? The fans were really into this. I mean, they were hot for this segment. Brie Bella ended up quitting. It's exactly as I figured. She didn't want Bryan to have to forfeit everything that he worked so hard for. I think she called Stephanie a bitch. She slapped her right across the face. People went apeshit for it. Bryan didn't look too unhappy that his wife had just quit her job when the segment was over. They seemed pretty happy with themselves after what happened. So I thought it was a hot segment. Everything else was just kind of there. You know, there was some good matches on the show. You know, people were very upset when I made the comment on Twitter. I said it was a good show because the two main events delivered and the Brie stuff got over big live in front of that crowd, which it did. Everything else was just kind of there. It was like, meh, it was all right. And people got so bent out of how can you say that? You know, Sheamus and Cesaro had a great match. It was okay. Believe me, both men have had much better matches. I've seen Sheamus have better matches with Del Rio when they first started feuding. Much better matches with Daniel Bryan. Cesaro's had better matches. I wasn't a fan of the finish. People thought I was crazy. You know, oh, it was so clever what they did here. Cesaro got beat, but not really because they did this small package out of nowhere. I mean, yeah, there's a time and a place for small package finishes. It just, didn't impress me. I wasn't a fan. So everything else was just kind of there. There was nothing else outstanding about the show. But the main events delivered. So it was a good pay-per-view. I'll still take TakeOver over Payback. I thought TakeOver was a more enjoyable show. And there was nothing on this pay-per-view that felt as epic to me as that Divas match between Natalya and Charlotte from TakeOver. Which I think was an eye-opener for a lot of people who just don't look at women's wrestling that way. There was nothing on this show that even came close to feeling as epic as that match did. But it was a good show. It was a good show. Raw, Monday night, was not a good show. Raw was live from Indianapolis. I turned the show off after the Ziggler segment. Okay, see what I did there? I didn't even try. But no, I did. I turned the show off. I was so thoroughly disgusted that they would have Del Rio go over Ziggler to qualify for a spot in the Money in the Bank match, which is technically still a pay-per-view. And Del Rio has been Del Jabo for so long, and Ziggler has too. But again, you put Ziggler next to Del Rio, and you tell me who has more potential. I went over this already in the segment with Ziggler and Miz. Miz is good. Put the two side by side. Who has more potential to go further in that company? There's only one answer. So they have, so they have him lose. Taps out clean to the armbar. Finish we've seen a million times before. And I was just so pissed off, I just turned the show off. So I don't know what happened in the next two segments. Apparently there were two more segments. I think there was a Cody Rhodes Goldust tag team match or something like that, and then Rusev, but I didn't see it. And then I heard about what happened in the final segment. That's what I get for turning the show off. You see, I get angry with Raw, and I turn it off, and the fucking Shield breaks up. I get angry and turn off Impact, and I miss absolutely nothing. That's the big difference between those two shows. So yeah, they broke up the hottest act in the company. They pulled the trigger. One of the most memorable closing angles in Raw history. Not the best or anything like that, but it was shocking. People are still talking about it. It's not even a week later. It got a lot of people talking, which is probably what they wanted. It was unpredictable, which isn't something you can say about much in wrestling these days, thanks to the internet and thanks to bad booking. But this wasn't bad. It was sad, but it wasn't bad. People definitely did not want to see it. You could actually hear a fan scream no just before Rollins whacked Reigns with the chair. Actually, I could do an even better impression of what the guy sounded like. He pretty much sounded like this.
No!
Like Reigns was about to take a bullet. Like if the guy could, he would jump in front of that chair. You know, like one of the Secret Service agents protecting the president or something. But that, hey, the guy said out loud exactly what I was thinking when I watched it. You know, I'm still in mourning over this whole thing. I wouldn't have done it. Myself would not have done it. I would not have turned the Shield against each other. I would not have broken them up. I still think there's money in keeping those guys together for a little while longer. But they did it, and it was a hot angle. The only thing that would have made it better and left more of a lasting impact was Jim Ross on commentary. When somebody would turn and do something dastardly like this back in the day, nobody sold it better than JR. And I thought the announcers did a poor job on this. It just was too subdued, and it didn't have the same impact. And the announcing can play such an important role in remembering an angle like this, or just selling how big of a deal and how much of an asshole this guy really is for what he did. So I thought it was lacking. That was one of those moments that JR would have been perfect still being in the announce booth. What made the Shield so great now, I guess, as we look back and we reflect on the last 18 months of these guys together on the main roster, what differentiated them from so many other groups is that there was no clear, distinct leader. You know, they were all equals. It was usually Rollins or Reigns. You know, Ambrose was kind of the loose cannon, but he had his time to shine too on occasion. Sometimes during promos, he would kind of dominate and take that leadership role. With the Horsemen, it was always, you know, Ric Flair. It was never a question of who the head guy, who the leader of the Four Horsemen was. Through all the different incarnations of the Horsemen, the one constant was Ric Flair. He was the guy. With the Freebirds, it was Michael Hayes. With the NWO, it was Hulk Hogan. With DX, it was Shawn Michaels. And then when he went away, it was Triple H. He took over the leadership role. With the Hart Foundation, it was Bret Hart. With the Ministry, it was The Undertaker. Evolution, again, it was Hunter. With the Shield, all three guys were on equal footing. And each made the other one better. Between that and the run that they had, I know this, you know, again, was only 18 months, but by today's standards, that's like 5 years. The fact that they kept these guys together for that long before breaking them up, as well as they were booked, almost always in main events, elevating everybody else's game that they worked with, never having a bad match, getting over as babyfaces after their heel run came to an end. In my opinion, the Shield's going to go down as one of the greatest groups of all time. Bar none. Easily one of the greatest factions of all time. When I say one of the greatest, I'm talking like, I can't say number one, I won't say number one, but top three. All time. Their wars with the Wyatts, their wars with Evolution, their battles with Bryan, their battles with Punk, working with The Undertaker at a time when Undertaker doesn't do much other than his once annual WrestleMania match. Okay, and he actually worked a six-man tag on Raw and a singles match on SmackDown against Dean Ambrose. When was the last time you saw Undertaker work a match on SmackDown? Veteran guys wanted to work with these guys because they were that good. The Outlaws at WrestleMania this year, right? So it's a sad day that these guys are no more. As for an explanation for why, for this to make sense, Mitch on Twitter had maybe the best answer. He said the simple answer is the Shield were mercenaries for hire. Rollins took a job and I guess saw the other two as being weak. I see people thinking, or maybe it's more like hoping that this is some giant swerve. The problem with this being a double swerve, or Rollins being a secret agent, is that it makes no sense. These guys, the Shield and Evolution, they beat the crap out of each other. Two straight pay-per-views, not to mention all the Raws and the SmackDowns in between that built up the pay-per-views. Okay, Rollins dove off a balcony at Extreme Rules onto those guys. Triple H and Randy Orton, he dove off the Titantron onto them at Payback. I think it was Rollins, he ate a pedigree on a steel chair on the stage last Sunday. Him turning doesn't make much sense as it is, but at least you could argue, okay, Triple H promised him a title shot, he promised him a bunch of money. He was tired of being overlooked as the architect of the Shield. Reigns is the muscle. He's looked at as the chosen one. He feels he gets no respect. You could at least rationalize it, and that may be what they end up doing. But if after all that, plus the beatdown on Ambrose and Reigns on Monday night, if Rollins really is still in cahoots with them and he joined Evolution to destroy Evolution from within, what is there to destroy? They've beaten them on two straight pay-per-views. Batista quit in the first segment of the show, so Evolution was down to two guys. I mean, what are they infiltrating exactly? The COO? I mean, what, are they going to oust him from power somehow? You know, when the old Stone Cold came back, remember that whole angle? He came back to lead Team WWF against the Alliance, and then he turned on them at the Invasion pay-per-view. That actually made sense. Vince begged Austin to come back and save his company from the invaders. Austin did, but not really. He just suckered McMahon so he could cost them that big main event at the pay-per-view and then lead the charge against the WWF. What big match is brewing between Evolution and the Shield that Rollins needs to infiltrate? Now, if this happened, let's say, between Extreme Rules and Payback, that actually would kind of make sense. You know, but again, they've already fought twice. Believe me, I would love nothing more than for this to somehow all make sense, and in 2 months the Shield is back together, you know, and each guy starts branching off on their own as singles, but they kind of maintain their partnership, they maintain their friendship, because the real money is in these guys as singles in the future. Okay, I know that. But I would love for it to be a ruse. It's just too far-fetched for me. Now, that said, let's talk about Seth Rollins here for a second. This is a big opportunity for Seth Rollins. And I am looking forward to seeing how serious they really are about pushing him as a heel. He was always, up until recently, he was always looked at as the odd man out because Ambrose is this crazy loose cannon, Brian Pillman, Roddy Piper hybrid. He's going to be just fine. And Reigns is big and he looks good and he's got big muscles and he's being positioned as the next top guy to replace John Cena. And that may all be true. But then Rollins kind of got the shaft. Like, oh, he's a good bumper, he's a good wrestler, he's a good hand. But, you know, of all three, in a lot of people's eyes, Rollins was the one guy who maybe he wouldn't be a world champion, or maybe he wouldn't get over the way the other two did. And I think the last few months, the way that they've let him shine, he's proved a lot of people wrong. He's changed people's opinions on that. So now he's the one who gets the first shot to branch out on his own in a serious role, as a singles guy, as a heel. I still think his future is as a babyface. He had the best babyface comeback in all of WWE. Bryan used to, but Rollins had it now, and now that's gone. I'm not saying he can't be a good heel. He can certainly, you know, he can bump around for people, which you have to do when you're a bad guy. But they're putting him in Evolution, if he is in Evolution. We're just assuming he is. Maybe he took whatever Triple H offered him just to break away and beat the crap out of his friends. But are they aligning him with Hunter and Orton because they see him as the next big thing? You know, that's the question. All three members of the Shield could be world champions at some point. You know, are we going to see Bryan versus Rollins? I mean, sign me up. That'd be a hell of a match. Rollins could probably give John Cena some of the best matches of his career, but I don't want to see Rollins and Cena. That's the problem with being a heel in WWE. At some point, they all crash into the brick wall called John Cena. And as we've seen before with everybody, pretty much except Daniel Bryan, so far, there's no going through that wall when you hit it. So I'm very curious how they handle this. The key is in the follow-up. I saw the Rollins stuff on SmackDown. He came out with Triple H. He cut a promo, but he didn't reveal why he turned. It was kind of a cop-out answer. Maybe they're saving it for Monday night, because that's the A show. He had a match with Dolph Ziggler that was actually pretty damn good. And they gave Ziggler a lot more, I will say, in that match than I thought they would. But in the end, Rollins got the win, curb stomp, got the pin. They didn't do much more than that. But the key is in the follow-up. Do they see this guy as the next big thing, and are they going to push him like that? And is he going to get the rub from rubbing shoulders with Triple H and Randy Orton? Or is he just going to be a lackey and play second fiddle to Triple H? Are they going to make him, you know, cut his hair and put him in a suit so he looks just like every other, you know, guy on the roster when they turn heel? Like, the key is how they handle it. You know, give the guy his own distinct identity. I have no problem if they want to keep him in his Shield gear for a while. You know, eventually he'll have to transition over to, like, normal tights, but let him stay in the flak jacket. Let him wear the gloves. Let him keep, you know, one half of his head blonde and the other half brown. Let him maintain his own identity, but don't make it where he's just Triple H's lapdog. Because the minute you do that, the guy's dead. Stephanie McMahon on the show announced that Daniel Bryan will defend the WWE Championship against the Demon Kane in a stretcher match on June 29th at the Money in the Bank pay-per-view. So I guess that changed from a Buried Alive match somewhere along the way. And if he is still not medically cleared to compete in time, then he will be stripped of the championship. And instead, for the first time ever, the title will be contested in a Money in the Bank ladder match. Apparently this is a shoot. They really do not know if Bryan is going to be ready in time. So the plan that they've come up with is exactly what Stephanie said on Monday night. They've got him booked for a bunch of house shows next month, so they obviously think he'll be back by then. Seems kind of goofy for them to wait all of this time, then strip him if he's going to be back a couple of weeks later, but that's the plan. But then there was a report in The Observer this past week that was very troubling. There may be bigger problems with Daniel Bryan than they're letting on. It's being reported that Bryan's rehab is going a lot slower than expected. And not only is he not making gains, but he's actually losing strength in his right arm, which is pretty scary to hear. He got sent back to Pittsburgh to see Dr. Maroon. He's the guy who did the neck surgery on Bryan to see what was wrong. I don't know what came of that. Obviously, they haven't said anything about any of this. So Bryan's going to be back on Raw this Monday. He's going to have another segment with Stephanie. It sounds to me like they're putting pressure on this guy to come back early. I mean, even if they're not saying that, if they're not telling him, hey, we need you back, you got to come back, just based on the way they booked this thing, he's got to be under a lot of pressure. You know, you're dealing with neck and nerve issues here. That's not the sort of thing you need to be rushing back early from. Let him take whatever time he needs to heal up and come back strong, because he's the number two guy on that roster behind John Cena. They can't afford to lose this guy long term. It's one thing to have neck surgery and be out 2 or 3 months. You come back early and you mess things up, that's bad news. You know, I read that stuff about his arm and it scared the hell out of me. There are guys who have had nerve issues from neck surgeries and neck injuries, and they kept on going and they made it worse. And their muscles started to atrophy. You know, it happened to Paul Orndorff. It happened to Kurt Angle. Bryan does not need to end up like Kurt Angle. So there's a very real possibility he's not going to be back in time. And if he is, I'm going to be cringing the whole time I watch that match with Kane, probably for more reasons than one. I've read the plan for SummerSlam, supposedly, is for Bryan against Brock. And believe me, nobody wants to see that match more than I do. I wrote a whole column about it on the Layfield Report, back after the Royal Rumble. But the dude's got to take care of himself first. I just hope he doesn't rush back too quickly. The other big news on this show, as I mentioned, is that Blutista quit the company. Yet again, no wheelchair this time. This time it was the beauty pageant wave, which was priceless. I will miss heel Big Dave, I have to say. He'll be back in a few months. Whose outfits are we going to make fun of now? He was such an easy target. Skinny jeans and the blue, especially when he ripped his jeans that one time. That was a memorable moment. Some other observations. Cesaro must remove the stick from his ass when he walks to the ring. It's almost as bad as the yodeling. He looks like a video game character now when he walks down to the ring. Seriously, he looks like a guy from one of those old WWE video games. You know, they're these giant block characters when they move around and they walk down to the ring. Just completely unnatural. RVD and Sheamus beat Cesaro and Bad News Barrett when Cesaro walked out on Barrett. So the bad news for Barrett here, brogue kick into the 5-star frog splash for the pin. Damian Sandow came out dressed up as Lance Stevenson from the Indiana Pacers. Stevenson actually went to high school here in Brooklyn. I bet you didn't know that. He did. in Coney Island, which is where I'm going to be next weekend. He made fun of the Pacers, then he played with a basketball until the Big Show came down, knocked him out. Here's what I don't get about the Sandow stuff. If they want him to do comedy, fine. But I seem to recall him coming out on the Raw pre-show a few weeks ago, a month ago, whatever it was, and he was talking about, it was almost like a work shoot they were trying to do with him. He comes out, he's talking about how they want me to play characters and do, you know, stupid shit, and I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do what they want me to do. So is he supposed to be a hypocrite? Like, is that his gimmick? Because that's exactly what he's been doing ever since. Every single week he comes out, he's Davy Crockett, he's Lance Storm here on this show, or Lance Stevenson. You know, he's playing different characters. He was Vanilla Ice, I think, a few weeks ago. I just don't see what the point of any of this is. Bo Dallas came out before his match with Kofi Kingston and also made fun of the Pacers. They used the same cheap heel heat in back-to-back segments. Now that is what you call lazy writing. Could do better than that. He won with an ugly-looking Bodog, which is the name of his bulldog off the ropes. Then he did a victory lap around the ring. Lionel on our Facebook group page had a great suggestion. He says, Bo Dallas needs a submission finish that when he locks it in, he encourages his opponent to not give up. It's ingenious. I love it. They'll never do it, but I love it. Somewhere in here, I have it in my notes, Jerry Lawler said, and I quote, I love the universe. Looks like Lawler missed his calling. He should have majored in astronomy if he loves the universe so much. It's never too late, Jerry. You can leave now and go back to school. We won't mind. We got a match between John Cena and the Demon Kane. Yes, John Cena versus Kane. Jesus Christ. Kane got DQ'd for punching Cena too many times. Not making any of this up. That's such an awesome finish. This was terrible. We had another great, and by great I mean embarrassing, Lawler line here during this segment where he actually said, John Cena can't possibly lift up those ring steps. This came, by the way, after John Cena not only lifted the ring steps 24 hours earlier at the pay-per-view, but on that pay-per-view, he launched the ring steps like a missile at Bray Wyatt's head. And Lawler called that match on the same pay-per-view. But apparently here, John Cena can't do it. It's an unbelievable feat of strength for John Cena to pick up the ring steps here on this show. Alicia Fox and Oksana beat Nikki Bella in a handicap match. Alicia Fox nailed her axe kick of death, got the pin. Then they beat up Nikki forever after the match. John Cena is a terrible boyfriend, by the way. Let his girlfriend die out there. They were just kicking her ass. It's like a mugging. The match is already over. And he just leaves her for dead. But then again, he never saves any of the other baby faces when they're being killed. The Wyatts beat the Usos in a pretty good little tag team match. Non-title, of course. So the Wyatts are now in line for a shot at the belts. I don't know that they're actually winning them. I've read in places that the Ascension may be on their way up. They may be about to ascend to the main roster. I'm sorry for that joke. That was horrible. That's like WWE comedy there. I apologize. But yeah, they may be up on the main roster soon from NXT. I would think that they would keep the belts on the Usos if they're going to have them challenge for the belts right away. Maybe they won't. You know, maybe they'll phase them in. They'll give them vignettes and they'll build it up for a while. Then came the Ziggler match with Del Rio. Just seriously, fuck this company. Just fuck them. Randy Orton versus Roman Reigns was the main event, but it never got started because Seth Rollins turned on Reigns and Ambrose with a chair. He beat the crap out of him with that chair. Which, again, if this was all just a ruse, I understand that they would have to make it look real and convincing to convince the authority that, in fact, this guy had turned. But I don't know. I don't think I'd ever agree to let somebody beat the shit out of me the way he did here with that chair. And that's how they went off the air with that shocking turn of events that was certainly newsworthy, and that's what this Raw will be remembered for. And actually, in a lot of ways, it kind of reminds me of that Raw show from many years ago where the Nexus came out. It was during a Punk Cena match when Punk was still wearing the mask. He was doing that gimmick. I guess that was probably after he got shaved bald. And all the Nexus guys came out for that. They invaded. They destroyed the ringside area. They tore up the ring. They beat up Jerry Lawler. All of this stuff. It was one of the most memorable angles in the history of that show. But I still to this day remember that show. It was one of those 3-hour specials before Raw became 3 hours permanently. And that show was a pile of shit. Go back and look up the results of that show. I just remember that show was so horrendous, and it always made me wonder if they did that on purpose, if they made the show so unremarkable and so crappy on purpose because it would make that final angle stand out that much more, because that angle was one of the best they ever did. And this was not an all-time horrible edition of Raw. It was a bad show that just was mostly boring, and nothing overly special happened aside from Batista quitting. But then at the end, it's like, bam, they kind of hit you between the eyes with a major angle. And that's all anybody's been talking about ever since. So that's kind of what that reminded me of. One more WWE note here, and this is actually a positive story. They sent out letters recently to all wrestlers and referees in their database who used to be under contract at one time or another, offering financial assistance and debt planning through a firm that they have contracted with. So that includes help for guys who may be in debt, things like debt consolidation. They're also offering $5,000 per semester in scholarship money for any former talents who want to go to college. They have to enroll by August 1st to be eligible for the fall semester. That's a really cool thing for them to do. Whatever their motivations are, they don't have to do it. You know, I mean, how many companies offer financial planning and scholarship money to former employees? You know, and technically they're not even employees, right? They're independent contractors. So I think that's pretty cool. Jim Ross for years has talked about, you know, when he was the head of talent relations and always trying to impress upon guys how to save their money, how to make sure their paperwork was filed with the IRS, and a lot of guys just didn't take that advice or they didn't know because the tax laws vary state to state. And when you're a wrestler, technically you're working in different states at different times, and you need to know what the tax laws are in each state, which is a gigantic pain in the ass. And it can be legitimately confusing if you don't know what the hell you're doing. So this seems to only apply to former talent, but it's a step in the right direction. I think they do teach the guys down at NXT about financial planning or encouraging them to, you know, manage their money correctly and look into the future and retirement. And I think they do. I could be wrong, but I thought they did. But I thought that was a really positive story. It sounds on the surface like something they don't have to do. You can call it good PR, call it whatever you want to. They're doing something with this that no other wrestling company is doing. So I give them a thumbs up on that. Before we get into the NXT review, I just have to mention Legends House. I haven't talked about Legends House a lot here on the show, but I've been keeping up with it. I enjoy it for what it is. It's not a great show. If it were on some cable station, it would totally bomb. I could see why no network picked it up, but I enjoy it for what it is. The final episode is coming up on Thursday, so they're almost done with it, but the episode that aired on Thursday, I have to say, that's the first time that I've actually cried while watching this show, and I am mad enough to admit it. They were going along. The whole theme of the show was the guys were going to roast Roddy Piper. That's kind of the task that they came up with. So they had to prepare jokes. They brought in comedians to work with each guy. Piper had somebody working with him on rebuttals for each guy. The Iron Sheik made a surprise cameo appearance at the roast, and I can guarantee you that all the good Sheik stuff had to be cut from that show. I can only imagine how much stuff he said that was edited off the show. It was a very small dose of the Iron Sheik, but it was fun. It was a fun show. But at the end, when they go back to the house, okay, because it was almost like a bonding experience for them. They go back to the house, they're sitting around the table, they're eating and drinking, and everything seems to be cool. It's like, finally, these guys are getting along, they've really bonded. And then it all just turns to shit. Somebody said something, and it just degenerated from there. They started, like, Roddy Piper got really angry at Howard Finkel for something he had done on an earlier show. It was a respect thing. They were in a limo, and Fink took the catbird seat in the limo, which is just not something you do. You give that seat up to, you know, one of the other legends, one of the wrestlers. And obviously Piper did not forget about that because he threw it right back in Finkel's face. I felt bad for Fink. Fink comes off as such a nice guy, and I'm sure, you know, he meant no ill will, but you could tell he was really hurt by it. You know, Howard Finkel, I mean, all of these guys to some degree, But Howard Finkel is a guy, he's been with WWE for how many years now? 30, 40 years? He was like the first employee, you know, he was hired in the late 70s. He's been there ever since. The only thing the guy knows is wrestling. I don't think he's married. It's like wrestling is all he has. It means so much to him. So you could tell how hurt he was, and that kind of sucked. Pat Patterson went on this random diatribe, and he started crying about, I'm tired of being phony. Why can't we just be ourselves? And, you know, I'm Pierre Clermont. I'm not Pat Patterson. And it almost sounded like a guy, you know, because, you know, Pat Patterson is gay. It's kind of an open secret. It's not really much of a secret. He's been out for decades. It's not like it's been hidden for so long. But it almost was like his way of coming out on the show without actually saying it. And it was just very weird. But what made me, what got me all choked up was this one little scene that came at the end of the episode. They go to a different part of the house, and Tony Atlas is eating. What else is new? That's all Tony Atlas ever does is eat. Although to his credit, I gotta say, Tony Atlas is 60-something years old. His arms are as big as ever. The guy is in frickin' good shape, especially, I can't even say for a guy his age. The guy is in good shape, period. So he's eating a salad or whatever he's eating, and Jimmy Hart is there with him. And Jimmy Hart is not portrayed on this show in the best of light. He comes off on the show as being annoying as all hell. Nobody likes him. You know, he's a picky eater. He doesn't eat anything except like a salad and stuff. He can't eat this, he can't eat that. He's always just being annoying. I'm sure a lot of that has to do with just the way the show is filmed. That's the role they chose for him. Because Jimmy Hart's another guy. He just comes off as the nicest guy in the world. Like, how could anybody hate Jimmy Hart? All of a sudden, I guess coming off that dinner the night before, it's all about kind of being real, right, and being honest. And he reveals that his daughter died recently. I think earlier this year or last year. Actually, I guess this show was taped a couple of years ago, but it would have been shortly before filming. He tells Tony Atlas that his daughter died. You know, he got the call from his son one day saying she was dead, and it was like, whoa. And all of a sudden, you know, he's talking, and then he just starts to break down and cry. And Tony Atlas is like, he gets up from the table, he's like, it's okay. He puts his arm around Jimmy Hart. Jimmy Hart just bawling his eyes out. And I didn't know. I don't know that anybody really knew. I mean, maybe he told Hogan, since the two of them are, you know, best buddies. But, you know, you can do searching on the internet. You know, you don't find a lot about Jimmy Hart and his family. I know he's got a couple of other kids, Jimmy Hart Jr. You know, he mentioned that on the show. His family had been through a lot. Thankfully, you know, at least he came back from Iraq because he was serving overseas. But he mentioned his daughter, you know, dying. I don't know what happened. And to see Jimmy Hart break down, you know, I've never seen Jimmy Hart cry his eyes out like this. It's like, oh, man, that just hit me right in the chest. And that was rough. That's when Legends House got real for the first time. That was pretty emotional stuff. And again, nobody knew because he didn't tell anybody. This was like the first time he was revealing it to people other than maybe his inner circle. So that was rough stuff there at the end of the episode. But there's one more left. I've enjoyed it for what it is. It sounds like they're going to do a second season because it actually did pretty well on the network. A lot of people, I guess, have watched Legends House, so they're going to bring it back. I don't know who's going to be part of the new cast. I think if they're going to do it again, they got to change the whole cast, just blow it up, come up with 8 completely new people, try to use some more contemporary people maybe this time instead of guys from the 70s and the 80s, and I'll watch. I mean, I'm already paying $9.99 a month. Obviously, I'm going to watch it. So anyway, NXT was a good follow-up to TakeOver. Again, not an overly exciting show. Wasn't going to be what TakeOver was, but they've started building in some new directions on this show. They aired a graphic multiple times throughout this show for the Adrian Neville versus Justin Gabriel main event. And the graphic said that the match was no disqualification for the NXT Championship. That's what it said. I took a screenshot of this thing. Turned out to not be the case, which was disappointing. How something like that happens is a mystery to me. It's not the first time they've screwed up the graphics like that on this show. Do they use a developmental production team for NXT as well? Because at least that would explain it. Otherwise, it's just embarrassing how something like that even gets on the air. I mean, I'm watching that match, and the announcers are talking about how if Gabriel wins, he may be in line for a shot at the title. And I'm just sitting there thinking, I thought this was a title match. And then finally I figured out, no, it's not. And in fact, it's not even no DQ. They're just having a wrestling match. So imagine seeing a match like that hyped up for 45 minutes and then you find out it's just a regular match. It's kind of disappointing. Anyway, show opened with Mojo Rawley against Aiden English. Boy, talk about a guy who had something before and has nothing now. English is just deader than dead. And not just because of his pasty white skin, either. There's just nothing there with this guy now. Mojo did what Mojo always does. He won with the Earthquake Splash. He got the pin. Not sure what the point of having Rusev destroy him at TakeOver was if they're not going to do a match or a program or anything. At least from what someone at the taping said, they didn't. So I'm not quite sure why they did it. Bayley came out with her giant inflatable tube men on each side of her. I still love those things. I don't even know why, I just do. I hope they make it to the main roster with her. Actually, you know what, I take that back. I hope she stays on NXT. Because if they ever bring her up to the main roster, they'll just make her 3MB's female groupie, or some stupid shit like that. She wrestled Charlotte, the new women's champion. Once upon a time, you may recall, these two were best friends, until Charlotte turned on Bayley. And I don't recall them ever having a match since. They didn't even really play up their history much here. They just threw the match out there, which I think was a mistake. They could have built this thing up. They could have built up to Bayley as the first challenger for the title. I guess maybe they still can. I don't know why. She got beat clean here in this match. Bayley's got some wicked arm drag takedowns. I don't know if anybody notices that. I'm starting to study her matches a little bit more. And she's really, really good at that. She's actually a lot of fun to watch when she's in there. Summer Rae's music hit in the middle of the match. She's been off NXT for months. Charlotte and Sasha have been carrying around a stick with her face on it while she's been gone. But the leader of the BFFs was back. I thought for sure we were getting a fucking distraction roll-up finish here because Charlotte, all Charlotte could do, she heard the music and she's just looking like, what are you doing here? And I'm like, oh God, here we go. Here it comes, their favorite go-to finish. But they surprised me. Bayley tried. She tried the roll-up. Charlotte rolled through, got up, and finished Bayley off with her bow down to the queen move and got the pin. And afterwards, all three BFFs started putting the boots to Bayley when Paige and Emma ran down to the ring together to make the save. I thought that was pretty cool. Although I have to ask the question yet again, if Paige is still appearing on NXT, then why was it so important she be stripped of that title? Looks like they're building to a six diva match, which is fine by me. Emma's been completely wasted on the main roster so far. They may as well just send her back down to NXT. Probably be better off. Backstage later on, they teased dissension between Summer and Charlotte, with Summer acting all high and mighty. I'm on Total Divas now, I'm in Hollywood. So they're clearly building to a title match between the two of them at some point. I would presume with Charlotte being the babyface, because Summer just comes off as a total bitch. We got a weird backstage segment with the new team of Jason Jordan and Ty Dillinger. All you need to know about this is that it was horrendously unfunny. That's all you need to know. Jordan and Dillinger had a match against the team of Stuart Cumberland and Philip Gouljar. This was awesome because William Regal just could not stop saying Gouljar's name. He just thought it was so cool to keep saying Gouljar. It's an interesting name. I don't know if that's his real name or not. He was just a jobber here. I've never seen him before. It's possible it's his real name. I don't know who could possibly come up with that as a fake name. It seems to me like it could only be somebody's real name. And if it is, I hope they let him use it. It certainly stands out. Gouljar. Gouljar actually had some violent streaks in him here in this match. He looked a lot better than his partner did. He was kicking ass at one point. But in the end, Jordan and Dillinger got the win. They're building them up as a unit. I see a lot of people were bored. They thought this was terrible. I thought it was fine. It was what it was. You know, I look at this in a lot of ways as the old Superstars and Wrestling Challenge shows. And even Monday Night Raw back in the day. We don't have enhancement matches anymore. We don't have jobber matches anymore. And that's kind of what this was. I mean, it's four guys that people really don't know. So I get that. You know, you don't know who to cheer for. You're kind of boring. Like, oh, okay, it's four dudes I don't know. But they're trying to build up Jordan and Dillinger as a team. They desperately need new tag teams. So I encourage them to do more of that. I like to see them do more of that. Take two guys who have no direction, who are probably not going anywhere right now on their own, put them together in a team, and let's see if they have any chemistry. You know, some of the biggest stars in the history of wrestling started out in a tag team. Maybe these guys have some chemistry, and they work together more, and they get good, and we'll actually get some new teams, because there's a tremendous lack of teams right now. You have the Ascension. You have El Local and Kalisto. I'm not even sure if they're a team anymore since they lost a takeover. You know, I hope that's not a permanent team. Who else do they have? They don't have any other teams. Let them build up some new ones. And I thought they looked good. You know, at one point Dillinger had, I don't know if it was Ghoul Jar or the other guy in the corner, he started giving him some loud chops. Brutal sounding knife edge chops that the crowd reacted to. So, you know, they had a little something here. We have to see more of them. I thought this was fine. CJ Parker was spotted wandering around the crowd in the NXT arena at the end of the match. He was holding a sign that read, "May the forest be with you," because he's an environmental nut. I didn't have to watch his stupid entrance, so this was fine. You know, let's give him 5 seconds of camera time every single week carrying signs. I can live with that. Then we had the number one contender to the NXT title, Tyler Breeze, make his way down to the ring to his brand new entrance music. I still miss the old music, but I don't hate the new music. In fact, it's grown on me so much where I now know all the words. I'm not ashamed to admit. I know all the words to Tyler Breeze's new song, and I like it. He said it would be up to him when he decided to cash in his title match against the man that Maybelline forgot, Adrian Neville. I guess that's a new wrinkle. The challenger gets to decide when he gets his title shot. He said last week he beat Seth Rogen's less good-looking brother to earn that shot. I like that line. Sami Zayn kind of does look like Seth Rogen a little bit, you know, minus about 50 pounds and a truckload of weed. He then introduced his new music video, which opened with a message on screen that read, "Dedicated to all my fans, even the Uggos. Love, Tyler." This was great. The video I thought was great. I loved it. Got a well-deserved "This is awesome" chant from the crowd at Full Sail when they came back live to the ring. With the Shield all broken up now, he's my favorite guy on the roster. Tyler Breeze. Dude's going to be a star. Not to be outdone, we got an extended video recap of Bo Dallas' meltdown after his loss to Big E a few weeks ago where he was exiled from NXT. They had footage here that they didn't even show on that episode a few weeks ago that somehow made this even funnier than it was the first time. He kept screaming at the fans to leave, go home. You know, they would tell him, "No, you leave." Then he would leave and walk backstage, but come back out, and he would threaten to call the cops on them if they didn't leave. Then he'd leave again, and you thought it was finally over, but then back out he comes, and he admits, "All right, I'm not really going to call the cops, but I'm definitely calling campus security if you people don't leave." This was awesome. Like, me talking about it doesn't even do it justice. If you've got the network, just queue up NXT. It's like midway through the show, this video package. It's awesome. This was fun. This is what wrestling should be. It was a fun segment. Main event was a non-title match, despite what the graphic may have said, between Adrian Neville and Justin Gabriel. Neville won clean with a red arrow off the top rope. It was a good match, but, you know, kind of disappointing. I expected more out of these two, but the match with Tyson Kidd at TakeOver had more time, and it was, you know, it was a better match. Speaking of Kidd, he came out when the match was over to confront Neville. He asked for one more shot at the NXT title, and the people in the crowd were shouting "fact" after everything he said, so apparently that's a thing now. He did use it in his promo himself, so I guess they want to make that his new catchphrase or something. He'll say something and say, you know, "fact" immediately after it. Neville agreed to a rematch with Kidd, and Kidd left without incident. So there's certainly a lot of heelish undertones to Tyson Kidd right now. I would think a turn is imminent, but we'll see. You know, at least he's not fading back into obscurity just yet. I figured when TakeOver was done that was it for Tyson Kidd. There's been rumors of them putting him in a mask maybe and giving him a new gimmick. I don't know what their plans are long-term with the guy. I'm sure they don't have any real long-term plans for him, but at least for now, he's got the spotlight for a few more weeks, and they're actually doing something with the guy. Check this out, guys. For you, the listeners of The Sound Off, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial so that you can check out their service. And it's a quality service. I wouldn't be mentioning it on my show if it wasn't. They have a bunch of wrestling books to choose from in audio form, including Lex Luger's book, Dusty Rhodes' book, Hulk Hogan's book is available with narration from the Hulkster himself. There's even one that chronicles the rise of the late Junkyard Dog in Mid-South, which sounds really interesting. You can choose any one of those free by trying audible.com. If you commute to work, or if you like listening to things other than music at the gym, I know a lot of people listen to this podcast that way. It seems to me an audiobook would absolutely make sense. To get one, make sure you go to audibletrial.com/solomonster. It's another way to show your support for The Sound Off, and you get something free in return. Can't beat that. Again, that's audibletrial.com/solomonster. TNA. What can I say about TNA? What can I say about TNA? I have a lot to say, actually. 2 weeks ago, I gave up on Impact halfway through the show, as many of you know. It was during the Dixie Carter MVP segment. I just could not take it anymore, and I stopped watching. Last week, I didn't even watch Impact. I just didn't have the time. And after that other show, I didn't see any reason to go out of my way to watch it. So I didn't. But I did say that I wasn't giving up on this show yet. I'm not swearing it off just yet. Partially because I have tickets to a show later this month, and I'll get into that in a second. I had every intention of getting back to the show, though, this week, and I did. Boy, was that a mistake. This was an awful show. And you know, I was thinking about this. These shows have been in the can for weeks now, just weeks and weeks. And next week is tape two, okay, and they have their pay-per-view coming up on the 15th. And looking back at the last month or so of TV, I've come to the realization that these most recent tapings they did were quite possibly the worst collection of tapings in the history of professional wrestling. Every show has been progressively worse than the one before it. Believe it or not, when the Menagerie first debuted, I liked him. I liked the act. Now, shit. The heel authority figure stuff is unbearable. The amount of talking on these shows. People are going to bitch about Raw, and they're going to say, well, WWE does the same thing. You know what? At least on Raw, most weeks, I know that we're going to get some good wrestling, sometimes great wrestling. Maybe less so now with The Shield broken up and Daniel Bryan on the shelf, but I can usually count on that. You rarely get that anymore on this show. At one time you did, but now you don't. Even the matches you think would be great, like Joe and Aries, or Eddie Edwards against Davey Richards, whether it's the empty arena that they're performing in front of, seemingly, if it's the announcers, I don't know what it is. But even those matches are not enjoyable. They're not fun. They lack any sense of purpose, any sense of drama. And I'm sure I'll get people who are going to say, well, if you don't like it, don't watch it. It's like the idiots who say, America, love it or leave it. You know, were it not for this podcast, at this point, I would not be watching Impact anymore. I would not have said that a few months ago. I started watching the full episodes 2 years ago. Because I genuinely started to enjoy the show. There was some kind of change that happened. Russo had left. Pritchard had been brought in. So in terms of the creative stuff, that was the big change that was made. Was it that? Was it something else? I don't know. And I think over on Raw at the time, it was John Cena against Big Johnny. John Laurinaitis. And that was like the big storyline on Raw. But last week may have been the first show I missed in 2 years. Now, I watch it because people enjoy the reviews on this podcast. And not just for the comedy, but because some people really do want to get caught up on what's going on in TNA without having to watch it themselves. Shit, I don't blame them. So I'm going to one of the New York City tapings at the end of this month with Brian Blade. We're going to the Manhattan Center, upstairs, to watch Impact be taped. I'm guessing two episodes, but I don't know what their plan is. I paid money, okay, good money, to go to this show. They need to knock these shows out of the fucking park. They need to load them up. They've got to give the crowd what they want. You know, based on what went down on the House of Hardcore show on Friday night with Tommy Dreamer claiming that Dixie Carter pulled Bully Ray from the show, and I'm going to get you back, bitch, and everybody should go tweet Dixie about what a bitch she is. Clearly they're doing an angle. I don't buy any of this. Wouldn't shock me to see them do some sort of invasion at the New York City tapings. and maybe have Dreamer even help Bully finally put Dixie through a table. They've been building that up for months. I don't know if that's the answer to their problems, but they've got to try something. I said this on Facebook. It's inconceivable to me that there were 993,000 homes that saw this show on Thursday night. It was their lowest rating in 6 months, but that's still almost a million people. Despite all of the money problems, all of the talent that they've lost, everything, despite it all, TNA is the luckiest promotion in the world. Because you go back 10, 15 years, if any other wrestling company put on the kind of shows that they've been putting on lately, they would have been canceled in a heartbeat. Done. Finished. But Spike has such shit programming on their network and fucking hours of Cops reruns, they're probably going to keep TNA around. I predict that Impact ends up staying exactly where it is. But yeah, I listen to AJ Styles on Chris Jericho's podcast politely bury the company, although he wasn't as kind to John Gaborik, who's the head of talent relations now. They brought him over from WWE. Big John from Tough Enough, he's pretty much running a lot of different things behind the scenes, I guess, in terms of talent relations and creative, and AJ was not as kind to him on the show. But, you know, I listened to him, and it only reinforced the fact that these people don't have a fucking clue what they're doing. It's astonishing to me that they've lasted as long as they have. 12 years they've survived. ECW didn't even last that long. They've had more of a lasting, you know, impact, I guess, no pun intended, on the wrestling business. People remember ECW fondly back in the day, but they had money issues, and they went out of business. And it's astonishing to me that TNA is still around. MVP, Kenny King, Bobby Lashley, they're out there at the beginning of the show on Thursday, making a match between Samoa Joe and Austin Aries, where the loser is fired from TNA. If I were those guys, I'd have taken a double countout and walked my ass back to Ring of Honor. Now keep in mind that in a backstage segment later in the show, MVP confronted Brian Hebner, the referee for the match, and told him in no uncertain terms that tonight there must be a winner and there must be a loser. Fast forward to the match, the fans didn't care about any of it, which tells you how much they buy into these loser-gets-fired stipulations. They wrestle for 5 minutes, and Eric Young comes down to the ring. He pulls Hebner out of the ring. He tells Hebner he doesn't have to do this, but Hebner insists, "I have no choice, I have a family to feed." Bully Ray comes down, he says, "I'm sorry, bro," and he decks Hebner, knocks him out. MVP and his crew make their way out, and this is the part where Bully proposes they have an 8-man tag team match pitting Bully, EY, Joe, and Aries against MVP, Kenny King, Bobby Lashley, and EC3. And then Eric Young suggests they make it an 8-man tag team first blood match. Why? Why not? MVP was going to say no, but Kenny King grabs the mic, got a little overzealous, and he accepted the match on their behalf, which made MVP very angry. He's the director of wrestling operations. He's throwing his weight around on this show every single week. Why can't he just overrule what Kenny King just said and say, "No, we're not doing the match"? That was dumb. As was the fact that we got no finish to a match that MVP himself said must have a winner. So we have another heel authority figure who makes stipulations and doesn't enforce them. We had Willow beating Bram by DQ when Magnus, the Parasite Hunter, that's my new nickname for him, came out and attacked Willow with a crowbar. The man who left TNA in a better position than it was in before he became the world champion. I guess he's embraced his dark side now, which made Bram very happy. MVP made a match between Davey Richards and Eddie Edwards, the tag team champions, and said there would have to be a definitive winner. You guys have to fight, or else I'm stripping you of the tag team belts. So they had a match that you would think would tear down the house, but the crowd was dead, and honestly, the match was okay. They only went like 4 minutes. Davey won with a cradle. This wasn't good enough for Kenny King. He came out, he said MVP wanted a definitive winner. He wanted you guys to fight, not exchange wrestling holds. I want to see punches and kicks. So they gave him what he wanted. They beat up Kenny King. Yet another MVP stipulation that's ignored. They're still the tag team champions, as far as I know. You wouldn't think a show featuring Samoa Joe against Austin Aries and Davey Richards against Eddie Edwards could be so boring. but they somehow managed to pull it off. Richards versus Edwards. I mean, that's the kind of match that you save for one of your New York City tapings. And you give them 15 minutes in the main event. Not four in a throwaway segment. Robbie E. is apparently terrified of clowns, which means he's terrified of the menagerie because the menagerie has a clown. They were all in the ring together. Zema Ion played his annoying air horn noise. Crazy Steve is squeezing his clown horn. They're having like a horn off here. Somehow this ended up with the Freak, who's Rob Terry under a mask, pressing Zema over his head for like 2 minutes straight while everybody else brawled. And then he dumped him out onto the heels outside of the ring. This was a gigantic waste of time. Mike Tenay and Taz, by the way, they're just like robots. They show no emotion. Taz, you know, Taz tries to be funny. Taz is a funny guy. He has his moments, but you can tell these guys, they're not motivated to do anything more than what's written for them on the page in front of them. And really, why would they be? What would give these guys the extra motivation to go out there and be excited about this shit? In the psych ward, Gunner was playing Go Fish with Sam Shaw. Ken Anderson dressed up as James Storm in what was supposed to be a parody, but it wasn't funny at all. Storm came out, he beat the shit out of Anderson, which I cheered, and then he challenged him to a match at Slammiversary. I didn't think it was possible to hate a babyface more than John Cena, but Anderson proves that theory wrong. I think he may be worse. Angelina Love beat Madison Rayne to retain her Knockouts title after Velvet Sky maced her in the face, or used hairspray or something like that, one or the other. Brittany is probably the hottest looking woman on their roster right now. All props to Velvet Sky, but I think Brittany is a very pretty woman, very attractive. It looks like they're teasing a lesbian gimmick between her and Madison. I didn't see the show last week, so maybe I missed something, but that's what it looks like. You know, and a lesbian angle. Gee, I wonder who came up with that idea. Madison made it clear to Brittany in the back earlier that she was not to interfere in her match later. Don't do anything. So Brittany was out there. She came down, but she didn't do anything. She didn't stop Velvet from, you know, macing Madison or anything like that. And then Madison bitched her out in the back for it after the match. And Brittany just said, listen, I was only doing what you told me to do. You told me not to do anything. So that story is continuing. The main event was a First Blood 8-man tag team match. We had Bully, EY, Aries, and Joe beating MVP, Lashley, Kenny King, and EC3 when EC3 got a small cut on his forehead. There was barely any blood, but it's red, so I guess that was good enough for Earl Hebner. Why even bother having a First Blood match if the blood is so insignificant? If you're going to have a First Blood match, do it right. I think that was EC3's first loss in TNA. They'll probably, you know, dismiss it because he wasn't pinned or tapped out. And yet again, instead of ending the show with their First Blood main event, I know I've talked about this before. Not the first time they've done this. Instead of going off the air with their actual main event, big match like that, we instead go backstage to a Dixie Carter MVP segment with Delusional Dixie, very upset that MVP and his goons beat up her nephew. MVP said that, you know, regimes have rarely been toppled without bloodshed. Then get ready to bleed, Dixie told him. And then the show ended. So I'm supposed to care about two heel authority figures that I don't give a shit about. And again, with this control of TNA bullshit, I feel like every single year of this company's existence, we've been stuck in this never-ending cycle of who has the power in TNA storylines. Who cares? Who cares who has the power in TNA? This show sucked. Now, after watching this show, I made the mistake of reading Vince Russo's blog. So maybe I'm a little harsher because I had just seen this show and went and read his blog on his website. He called it The Real Challenge Plaguing TNA. And I see all these wrestling websites, you know, heaping praise or saying, oh, it's well worth the read. Yeah, it's well worth the read for somebody from the perspective of somebody who once worked for the company. I'll give you that. But they're praising it like, oh, this is a, he hit the nail on the head, what a great piece. And I'm just thinking to myself, are you people out of your minds? He talks about how it's not creative, okay, because creative is all subjective. That's not the problem plaguing TNA. No, it's the crowds that are dead because they tape at Universal Studios. where there are no hardcore wrestling fans, and it's all theme park visitors who come inside because it's too hot outside. And then they tape two shows in one night, which makes the crowd tired. And on top of that, they don't show all the pre-tapes to the people in the building. So they can't get invested because they don't know what's going on or why this is happening or why that is happening. He's got a million and one excuses why TNA can never get ahead, and it has nothing to do with creative, which is probably the number one thing that's wrong with TNA right now. But here's a guy who's never taken responsibility for anything in his life, anything that he's ever been called out on before. It's never his fault. All the interviews that this guy has done, it's never his fault. It's always someone else's fault, or the fans were tired, or we didn't have enough money, or it was daylight savings time, or LeBron got a leg cramp, or I can't believe it's not butter, or whatever the excuse is, he's always got one. Everything he talked about there has some truth to it. The crowds are dead. And that hurts the show. But he talks about there being no hardcore wrestling fans there. NXT tapes its shows at Full Sail University in Winter Park, Florida. You know how far Winter Park is from Orlando? 7.3 miles. I know that because Google told me. That's a 13-minute drive. They're practically right next to each other. Watch any of those NXT shows. It sounds a lot like Smart Mark wrestling fans to me. It doesn't just sound like a bunch of college kids who know nothing about wrestling. NXT can get those people into the building. Why can't TNA? Stop making excuses. 900 people did not wander into the fucking impact zone because grandma was about to keel over from heat stroke. He says they tape 1.5 shows in the building, and so the fans get tired and they don't react. I'm sure that's true. WWE does 3 hours of Raw every single week, and their crowds have sucked lately. But I go back to NXT because it's the closest thing to Impact. I can't even compare Raw to Impact anymore. NXT to Impact is a more apt comparison these days. Go back to NXT. They tape 4 shows in one night, usually. Now, Impact is 2 hours, NXT is 1. So, technically, it's like taping 2 Impacts. And usually, the crowds for that 3rd and 4th NXT, they're not as boisterous as they were for the first 1 or 2. That doesn't excuse the crappy content on the show. And the pre-tape stuff, you know what, dude? Maybe that's a sign that you're doing too many pre-tapes. Maybe that's not what people want to see. Maybe more action and less talking. I've never seen more talking on a wrestling show than I have on Impact, from a promotion that calls itself Total Nonstop Action. A name, by the way, that we can credit to Vince Russo, who thought it would be a good idea to name a wrestling company after tits and ass. What about house shows? Tommy Dreamer just did somewhere in the range of 1,300 people for a show in Poughkeepsie, New York. At the same time, TNA was drawing maybe 200 people at a stadium show in Maryland. One has national TV exposure in 12 years of history. The other has no TV and had its first show a couple of years ago. How do you explain that one? Almost 1,800 words this guy wrote on his website in this blog, and not one time did he suggest, in a column titled "The Real Challenge Plaguing TNA," that maybe, just maybe, the actual problem is the product sucks. That you are the plague on TNA. So is Dixie. But this guy's fingerprints are all over these shows. Just because he has no contract with them doesn't mean he's not feeding them ideas. The fact that he sounds so defensive in this blog and he says nothing about creative is all the proof that you need. And after all these years, if the best these people can do is still rely on ideas from this guy, then you know what? They get exactly what they deserve. Let's get to your questions. If you have a question for the mailbag, you can email them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can also send MP3 audio questions as an attachment, and they may be used on the air. No matter what question you send in, please always include your name and where you are from. Kenny from Orlando, Florida. I wonder if that's Kenny King. Anyway, he has our first audio question this week.
Solomonster, how you doing? It's KC. Everybody knows that the Daniel Bryan, Kane, and Brie Bella storyline really sucks. My question to you is, what if they had the roles reversed and Kane was the babyface chasing Daniel Bryan, the heel champion? I think it would have been more successful because everybody would expect Daniel Bryan to run because he's a heel. I personally liked him better when he was a heel. He had more personality. Do you think it would have been more successful?
think Kenny may have been in a cave when he recorded that. I don't think it would have been much more successful. I just think it was a bad angle. You know, it was bad acting. You know, Brie was fine at Payback with what they did with her there. She was, you know, very limited, obviously, in what she had to say. She didn't have to fake cry or fake act. She called somebody a bitch and slapped him in the face. She can do that. But it was just bad acting from her, the champion running away. You know, we've seen Brian in the heel role before. He can be, yeah, he can play that role fine. I don't think it would have made that much of a difference. I just think it was a bad angle, plain and simple. This next audio question comes from Merlo Williams in Washington.
What's up, Solid Monster? Merlo Williams from Washington here. I know you mentioned on Twitter that a lot of people are asking you about Seth Rollins' heel turn. It's the first time I can remember since WrestleMania 25 when Shawn Michaels lost to The Undertaker that I was legitimately upset about something that happened in wrestling. When was the last time you can recall being that emotionally invested in a wrestling product?
That's a good question. I would probably say WrestleMania this year. I think the Daniel Bryan story of him having to wrestle twice in one night, having to go through Triple H to get to Orton and Batista and get the title shot, and then the final closing moments of that triple threat match, I think were awesome. Batista finally tapped, people went crazy, everyone was happy, confetti was falling from the ceiling. I mean, I've been following Bryan for a long time, so for me to be able to be there live in the building and see him kind of get that big payoff was a really cool moment. And it all happened by accident. You know, we all know the stories. I don't believe for a second that Bryan was supposed to go to WrestleMania and win the title. I believe the reports that they had him slotted in against Sheamus. I know some people refuse to believe that. I believe it. I believe that had Batista come back and people didn't boo him and people went nuts for him, he'd have won the Rumble and he'd have gone on to WrestleMania one-on-one against Orton, and that would have been your main event. And if Punk didn't go away, it would have been Punk against Triple H, and it would have been Undertaker and Brock, because Undertaker's match is always going to be up there. If it's not number one, it's going to be number two or number three, and Bryan would have been in the de facto number four spot against Sheamus. I do believe that. So things worked out a lot better. I bought into the story. You know, it was fun to be there. It was fun to be part of it, and I was hanging on every near fall in that main event. They got me. That Triple Threat main event was one of the best WrestleMania main events they've had in years. And that's coming from a guy who is not a fan of multi-man matches in the main event of Mania. I like one-on-one matches, but they had a great match, and I was invested in that story. So you don't have to go back very far. You know, every now and then they hit it out of the park, whether they mean to or not, and I think that we saw that at WrestleMania this year. Luis writes in, as much as I like Daniel Bryan and I'm happy he's champion, I feel this is a rather weak title reign, not just running away from Kane several weeks ago, but this past Monday with John Cena defending him to Stephanie. It makes me think that, or makes me think of that geek, I should say, in school, who was friends with one of the jocks, and every time that geek gets picked on, the jock comes along and tells everybody, come on guys, leave him alone. He's a really cool guy. If you're the top dog, having somebody constantly come to your defense saying, hey man, leave him alone, doesn't really help make you look like the big dog you're supposed to be. I agree 100%. I am also growing tired of John Cena coming out and having to talk about, well, you know, Daniel Bryan, you treat Daniel Bryan poorly, but he's good. What did he say on Monday? Did Cena say he was good? John Cena's like, he's good. I was like, good? That's the best you can come up with? That didn't do him any favors at all. I thought that was terrible. Unless this is some sort of early tease for a Cena-Bryan rematch where this is going to come up later on, where Bryan actually raises the issue of Cena constantly coming to his defense, or Cena one time on Raw saying, I was good, or something like that. I would be very impressed if they actually had some long-term thought on this, and in a few months, we come back to this moment as part of a storyline between those two guys. I think I'm giving them way too much credit. I don't think that's going to happen, but I agree with you. John Cena does not need... We all know John Cena is still the number one guy in the company. We all know this. He doesn't need the belts. He's number one. He'll always be number one as long as he's there. It's not going to be Bryan. It's not going to be even CM Punk. If Punk came back tomorrow, John Cena would still be considered the top guy in that company. It's not going to be any of those guys. It's not going to be Roman Reigns. Until Cena is gone, it's always going to be Cena. And he doesn't help that perception when he's got to be the one to come out and defend poor little Daniel Bryan. Let alone, you know, call him good which Stephanie agreed with, by the way. She goes, you're right. He is good. He's a B-plus player. It's not even like Stephanie disagreed with what Cena had to say. Hardly a ringing endorsement. Daniel from Toronto, would you rather have the WWE Network free for a year or have Raw go back to 2 hours permanently? I'd have Raw go back to 2 hours, without question. That was one of the easiest questions I've ever gotten in the mailbag. I will gladly pay my $10 a month for the network. It's a steal at that price. Even though I think they're dropping the ball by not having as much content on there right now as they should, it's still a steal for that price. I would pay an extra $10 a month to WWE if I knew it would help move Raw back to 2 hours. The show now is just too damn long. How many Raws that would have been considered great for 2 hours do you think have been reduced to just being okay or boring because of the three-hour format? Think about it like that. Think about how many great Raw shows there would have been were it not for that extra hour that just drags it right down into the abyss. Zach House of Pain Hulker from Preston, England writes in. That is one of the better PayPal nicknames I've given so far. I was watching the Royal Rumble and noticed the confrontation between Jack Swagger and Rusev. Could you see Swagger turning face and feuding with Rusev? Both are talented, and I don't believe Swagger has ever been a babyface. Do you see it being a good launching point for a face run? Well, if they were ever going to turn Jack Swagger babyface, that would be the way to do it. Keep building up Rusev, and then one day they have a backstage confrontation where they accidentally bump into each other, or something happens that sets Swagger's sights on this guy. And you could even keep Zeb with Swagger, because I think the pairing of Zeb and Swagger is great. And I could see Zeb being a babyface, the grouchy old man that people laugh at and cheer for one day. You can keep them together. They could still be the real Americans. But if you were going to do a Swagger babyface run, I think that would be the way to do it. Swagger, to me, doesn't come off as a babyface. He's just so easily hateable. He comes off as such a douche, you know. He's not the kind of the playboy, pretty boy he kind of was playing, I think, early on in his career. But I think that would be a good way to get that done. And if you want to do the, you know, USA Patriot Jack Swagger against the Russian sympathizer, former Bulgarian brute Rusev, it could probably even make for a good feud. I think they could have some good matches together. Because Rusev would probably be better matched up with other big guys who can go. Not a big guy like Khali, who can't go with anybody. He can go about 5 miles an hour. That's about as far as he can go. But I think Swagger and Rusev probably could have some pretty good matches, so I wouldn't mind seeing it. I just don't know what you do with Swagger after that once he's turned babyface. I don't see him going much higher than he is now. I just don't know, beyond a feud with Rusev, what you would do with the guy. I'd have to think about that. Silvino from Las Vegas, looking back at Brock Lesnar ending The Undertaker's streak, I wondered, if Brock Lesnar had never left the company, do you think he would have been the face of WWE? And if so, where do you think John Cena would be today? Had Brock Lesnar not left in 2004 and had he stuck around, I don't think Brock Lesnar would still be around as a full-time performer today anyway. There's no way he would have lasted as long, uninterrupted, as he would have from 04 to now. And that's a decade, dude. That's 10 years. So it's impossible to say. Had he stuck around, it probably wouldn't have been for that much longer. And now he'd probably just be part-time. So somebody else would have had to step up as the face. If it wasn't Cena, it would have been, I don't know, I mean, go back on the roster, Batista. Batista was kind of in the same role, but he was never truly number one, I think, except for 2005. When he first got over, won the title, he beat Triple H on 3 straight pay-per-views, he was the man. Once Cena got drafted over to Raw and Batista shifted over to SmackDown, that's where the change happened. That's when John Cena became a number one, and Batista became 1A. Okay, that's where you can trace that change back to. Because Raw was the A show. Except for a very limited amount of time in the early 2000s, in my opinion, Raw has always been the A show, and it always will be. So I think Cena probably would have ended up as the guy anyway, but there's no way Brock would have been the face of the company, even if he was around full-time, because Brock was not going to be the guy that you can put up there as the poster child for a lot of the charity stuff and a lot of the media stuff, because Brock just, he doesn't like doing it. And after a while, he would have gotten to that point where he's like, I'm not doing it. That's not who he is. You know, he never would have been that guy as, you know, the true face of the company as a wrestler, maybe, but not as like the representative or the spokesman. I just can't picture him in that role ever. This question comes from John. What's the point of creative control clauses in certain contracts? Would it jeopardize storylines or plans if the wrestler refuses or is not willing to lose? Well, I take you back to a little incident that took place in 1997. You may have heard of it, called the Montreal Screwjob. And one of the key points of that whole thing is that Bret Hart claimed he had creative control for the final 30 days of his contract. And Vince went and did what he did anyway. And so I guess Bret's position was, well, you can't do that. You're in breach of the contract. And that's really where a lot of the debate came in those final days and weeks leading up to the event, where Vince proposed, okay, let's do it this way. And Bret's like, well, you know what? I have creative control. I don't want to do it that way. I'm willing to do it X, Y, Z, but I'm not willing to do it that way. So yeah, I would say that it can cause some big problems. Hulk Hogan, pretty much wherever he went, once he left WWE, he went to WCW, he came back to WWE, he went to TNA. You know, as far as I know, everywhere he went, he had 100% creative control. He had final say and complete say over everything that he was involved in. And he got that power because he's Hulk Hogan. He got that power because he, you know, WCW wanted him in the worst way. And they got him, but he knew that. And he said, listen, I'll come, but only under my terms. And he got a cut of the pay-per-views and the merchandise, and he got a big fat paycheck, and he got the creative. He got everything he wanted because he knew he had all the leverage. He was smart. But was it a smart thing to do if you're WCW? Probably not. Because like you said, creates problems if Hogan, I'm using Hogan as an example, he hasn't been the only one, but if Hogan looks at this and says, yeah, I don't want to work with that guy, I don't want to lose, I don't want to do this, I look weak, I don't want to do that, and I'm sure he did plenty of times, creates a problem. And it probably creates resentment with the other guys. So yeah, I would say that that probably creates more headaches than, you know, any promotion really needs. Finally here, Ross from Edmonton, Alberta. Whatever happened to George and Adam? They were on many WWF commercials in the mid to late 90s, and they were portrayed as WWF superfans. I think I remember reading that George and Adam originally worked for Coliseum Video. They definitely worked for the company. I think they still work for WWE because they were in one of those Stand Up for WWE videos that they did a few years ago when the media was beating up on Linda during her Senate campaign, and that one columnist made a comment about how WWE was comparable to like porn or something like that, and Vince got this bug up his butt, let's start this Stand Up for WWE campaign. And it was a video with all of their employees that wanted to go on the record and voluntarily talk about what a great company WWE was. And I'm pretty sure George and Adam, if you can find it, were in that commercial. And that was only a few years ago, like 3 or 4 years ago. So my guess is they still work there. History has been made here! This week in wrestling history, we only have two more of these segments after this week. Two notable wrestling deaths on June 2nd this week in history. Sylvester Ritter, better known as the Junkyard Dog, died in a car crash back in 1998. He was 45 years old at the time. It was a single car accident. He fell asleep at the wheel while driving home from his daughter's high school graduation and rolled the car off the road. What's even more sad is that his daughter, the one who accepted the WWE Hall of Fame induction on behalf of her dad, also died. She died 3 years ago while on the phone with a friend. All of a sudden, the friend heard a loud thump, and when they found her, she was gone. She was dead. She was only 31. They still don't know what killed her. You know, I'm 31 years old, and the thought of just dropping dead like that at that age is frightening. So JYD's last wrestling appearance came at an ECW show the month before his death, their WrestlePalooza 98 event, where he was introduced during a legend ceremony, got one of the loudest ovations of the night. If you only know of JYD from his WWF stint, or worse, from his WCW stint, which was awful, you really need to get on YouTube or find WWE's Best of Mid-South Wrestling DVD. The guy was practically a god down there during that time. The other notable death was Classy Freddie Blassie, who passed away in 2003 at the ripe old age of 85. I still remember when they brought Blassie in during the Invasion storyline to give a pep talk to the WWE roster to kind of rally the troops against the Alliance, which was a great moment. And then the night where the old Stone Cold came back on Raw and stunnered everybody, and then they cut backstage to the closing scene with the Brooklyn Brawler wheeling Blassie out of the arena, and Stephanie McMahon comes over and stops them and says, "You know what you've got in common with the WWF, Freddie? You're both about to die." And I just remember thinking, man, that was cold. I know it's a TV show and all, but still, that was pretty low. His final appearance came on Raw just 3 weeks before his death. He was out there with his wife and Eric Bischoff, who was the Raw GM at the time, and he was about to sic his goons, 3-minute warning on Blassie before Steve Austin and the Dudleys came down to save him. Then they gave him a mic, and he said, "Devon, get the tables," and got a big pop. Yeah, Blassie was one of the all-time greats. He had a great wrestling career, and then he transitioned to being a manager. He was Hulk Hogan's manager when Hogan first came over in what was the WWWF at the time. He managed the Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkoff, High Chief Peter Maivia, Ray Stevens, Dick Murdoch, George the Animal Steele. He even managed Muhammad Ali in his boxer versus wrestler match against Antonio Inoki. He did a movie with Andy Kaufman in 1983 called My Breakfast with Blassie, which saw the two men have a discussion over breakfast in a restaurant. They talk about wrestling, they talk about why you shouldn't eat pancakes or waffles. It was a parody of another movie called My Dinner with Andre, and no, it has nothing to do with Andre the Giant, which I admit was my first thought when I first heard of that movie, but no, that has nothing to do with wrestling. 31 years ago this week, on June 2nd, 1983, the finals of what was called the first ever IWGP League were held in New Japan Pro Wrestling. IWGP, for those who don't know, stands for International Wrestling Grand Prix. They called it the IWGP League. It was a round-robin tournament with 10 of the top wrestlers from around the world. It had people like Andre the Giant, Hulk Hogan, Big John Studd, Antonio Inoki, Otto Wanz, and other people. You hear about a lot of guys who work for Otto Wanz later in Europe. Up to this point, New Japan had been using the National Wrestling Federation, or NWF, title as its main championship. Now, you may ask yourself, what the hell is the NWF title, and why was it defended in New Japan? Well, good question. It was actually a title for a promotion based in New York, of all places, in the 70s, until one day the champion took the title with him on a tour of Japan, and he lost it to Antonio Inoki, who defended it for many years after that. Inoki later gave up the belt, and they came up with this IWGP League deal that he entered himself into, which allowed them to get away from having to use the NWF title. Anyway, Hogan and Inoki ended up tied at 37 points in this round robin. So they wrestled in the finals with Hogan beating Inoki by countout, after he knocked Inoki off the apron with his big move, the dreaded Axe Bomber, which was really just a clothesline. Hogan, I have to say this, as big of a star as he became, Hogan made the most of the simplest moves. He got over with a leg drop. In Japan, he was known for a clothesline. Hogan never had to do weird, wacky moves to get himself over, so I give him a lot of credit for that. Inoki sold it like he was knocked out, which he may have been. There's always been debate about whether or not he was really knocked silly. One legend has it that Hogan legit knocked him out and only won because they were forced to change the finish. Inoki had given up his NWF title to be in this tournament, and the belief was that he was winning the whole thing, and that didn't happen. I think most people believe it was all part of the plan, which is what I tend to believe. If you've never seen Hogan wrestle in Japan back in his prime, go watch this match on YouTube. It's about half an hour long. Hogan could go when he had to. He wrestled the way he did here in this country because he knew he didn't have to work as hard and he could get away with flexing his biceps and cupping his hand to his ear. And he still had 8 back surgeries and a hip replacement. So yeah, you know, the human anatomy was not made for professional wrestling. I'm pretty sure Hogan got a belt, I think it was the IWGP belt, even though the title itself, it only goes back to about 1987. The idea was that you win the IWGP League and you are considered the best wrestler in the world. You're the guy to beat. It wasn't really a championship per se until 87. AJ Styles currently holds the IWGP championship for New Japan. He's one of only a handful of Americans who have had the honor of holding that title, so that's a big deal. But it's one of the most famous matches in wrestling history, that Hogan-Inoki match. Hogan actually came back to New Japan for a match with the Great Muta in 1993 in a match pitting the IWGP champion against the WWF champion, which Hogan was at the time. It may have been the only match that Hogan wrestled between WrestleMania 9 and the King of the Ring when he dropped the belt back to Yokozuna. And what's notable was the post-show press conference where Hogan basically trashed the WWF title, not physically, but just on the mic. He called it a trinket. He said the IWGP belt was more prestigious.
5 times World Wrestling Federation champion. This belt is just a toy. It's like a trinket on a Christmas tree, like an ornament. The belt that I want is the one that the great Muta has, the IWGP belt. Because when Hulk Hogan wins the IWGP championship, which he should have right now, it will prove that New Japan Pro Wrestling and Hulk Hogan is the greatest partners in the world, because I want all the great wrestlers to come to me, and I want them to come to Japan where I can wrestle and not bullshit. I want to wrestle and prove that I'm the best. Killer Ken, there's an old saying in the United States of America, and that you cannot teach an old dog new tricks. But this old dog does not need new tricks. I know all the tricks. I've proven that I'm a survivor. I've proven that I'm a leader. And I will not quit professional wrestling. Many, many people you've seen quit and come back. But if you watch Hulk Hogan, I have never quit. I will always be here. And now that I'm back in Japan, tonight was a great night for me because I was very worried. Because Muta is a brand new star. He's one of the best New Japan has. And tonight, it was fun. It was easy. I want bigger challenges. I want more opponents.
Yeah. Ichiban Hogan-san, Muta, down. Hogan is number one. I'm tired of wrestling the great Muta. I'm here in Japan for one reason, to prove that Ichiban lives forever. Ichiban is number one power. Inoki, Niban. Hulk Hogan has came back to Japan for his second life. For 10 years, Hulk Hogan has been in the WWF. Now Hulk Hogan used the WWF as a stepping stone to come back to Shinnopon Pro, New Japan Pro Wrestling, to prove that Axie Bumba is number one. Muta first, Antonio Inoki Niban.
Even his interviews in Japan were different. Hogan knew his audience. He knew the Hulkamania shit wouldn't fly over there the way it does over here. 28 years ago this week, on June 4th, 1986, Kerry Von Erich is severely injured in a motorcycle accident in Texas when he crashed into the back of a police car while trying to pass a truck on a two-lane highway. He was wearing shorts and no shoes at the time. He suffered a dislocated hip and a right foot so badly damaged he had to undergo 13 hours of surgery and still had the foot amputated later on. He returned to the ring. He had a prosthetic foot that he kept a secret from all but a few people close to him, although it was an open secret in wrestling for many years that he had no foot. It was after the amputation that he became addicted to painkillers. He had a lot of drug problems right up until the day that he killed himself. 27 years ago this week, on June 2nd, 1987, in what had to be considered a major upset at the time, the Honky Tonk Man beat Ricky the Dragon Steamboat to kick off what is to this day the longest intercontinental title reign in WWE history at a TV taping in Buffalo, New York. This came a little over 2 months after that epic match of WrestleMania 3 between Savage and Steamboat. Steamboat had requested time off to be with his wife, who was expecting the birth of their first son around that time. And I'm sure that did not sit well with Vince McMahon, who had just put his second most prestigious title in the company back when the intercontinental title actually meant something, and it usually was put on the workhorse in the company, so they relied very heavily on you as the Intercontinental Champion, even to headline some house shows. They would have an A team and a B team, sometimes a C team. They would run multiple shows on the same night. Hogan would lead one crew, and they would have, whether it was Savage or Honky Tonk or whoever, as the IC champ, lead the other crew. So from his perspective, I'm sure he could not have been very happy. He had just put the title on this guy, had plans for him to hold it for a hell of a lot longer than 2 months. So he dropped it to Honky Tonk. He came back, Steamboat did, in time for the first Survivor Series later that year, and he was never used in any sort of meaningful role in the company again. They lost their trust in the guy. He wasn't a team player, I guess. I could see both sides of it. You know, they just put the title on you and you asked for time off. At the same time, though, family first, you know? I always thought it was incredibly dumb to put him in the tournament for the title of WrestleMania 4. And on TV, in the weeks leading up to it, they were teasing a rematch between Steamboat and Savage, and then they didn't deliver. They had Greg Valentine beat Steamboat in the very first round. And by the way, just as an aside, I had read something on the Live Audio Wrestling website that Greg Valentine, I guess, was supposed to be at the Legends of Wrestling event in New Jersey this weekend. He pulled out because his daughter died. So that's terrible news. So thoughts with him. That's a horrible situation. But they had Valentine beat Steamboat in the very first round of that tournament of WrestleMania 4. Imagine how awesome that would have been to book a rematch between Savage and Steamboat, and this time have Savage go over, and they shake hands after the match, and then Savage goes on and wins the title. So anyway, he retired shortly thereafter. Steamboat then came back for that classic series of matches with Ric Flair in the NWA in 89, which was a nice way of sticking it to Vince McMahon, I would imagine. Honky Tonk Man would hold the title for 454 days and then lost it in 30 seconds to the Ultimate Warrior at SummerSlam. You know, this is another example of what if. I've done some of these history recaps before, and we say, well, what if this didn't happen, or what if it happened a different way? Like, we talk about a lot of big events in history, Brian Pillman getting hurt in that car wreck back in 96, Steve Austin getting dropped on his head back in 97 by Owen Hart. What if Steamboat had not asked for time off in 87, and he held on to the Intercontinental title for a long time, and Honky Tonk Man never got the belt, which he probably would not have? And if Honky doesn't get the belt, then he doesn't refuse to lose to Savage on that main event show the following year. And maybe Ted DiBiase becomes the WWF champion of WrestleMania 4 after all. You know, I mean, there's no way of knowing for sure. But all it takes is one small event to change the course of history sometimes. Steamboat may have done that here. 21 years ago this week, on June 6, 1993, Kevin Nash made his WWE debut as Shawn Michaels' new bodyguard, Diesel, at a live event in Albany, New York. He helped Michaels beat Marty Jannetty to win back the Intercontinental title on this show. A rare house show title change. Jannetty had only beaten Michaels for the belt about 3 weeks earlier on Monday Night Raw, so the click can trace its roots back to this show. This was the beginning here. And finally, 10 years ago this week, on June 3rd, 2004, the very first episode of TNA Impact debuted on Fox Sports Net. It was taped out of Universal Studios Orlando, so some things never change. And also saw the debut of the old six-sided ring that TNA used in its infancy. Only a handful of guys from that original show are still with the company today. Bobby Roode, James Storm, Eric Young, and Abyss. Chris Sabin and AJ Styles are gone now, but they were on that show as well. So is Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream. Of course, Impact is still on the air today on Spike TV, although for how much longer, that is the question. And that's this week in wrestling history. If you have questions for the mailbag segment, keep emailing them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. That goes for your MP3 questions as well. Use the hashtag Solomonster on Twitter if you want to talk about the show. You can follow me on there, @Solomonster is my handle. We're on Facebook as well. I have a profile page. We have a Facebook group page that you can apply to membership for, and a fan page that you can like. And we have a YouTube page. I know there hasn't been a lot of YouTube content up in a while. I do plan on doing more very soon, so you can find the official Solomonster Sounds Off channel on there, and then you can subscribe, so when a new video goes up, you will be alerted about that. You can listen to this show every single week on Stitcher Radio. You can download and subscribe to the show in iTunes. We have a free Android app that you can download in the Google Play Store. We have an unofficial fan-made sound-off app for Windows 8 users. No shortage of ways to download this podcast each and every week. And again, you can make a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com 24/7. That box is on the right-hand side. It's always up there. Please consider making a donation. And also trying out the Audible service. And if you do, you can use our custom URL, audibletrial.com/solomonster. You get to try the service out for 30 days free. You get one free audio book of your choice as part of that trial sign up. I get people who ask me, how can I support the show? Do you have an Amazon banner, like one of those Podcast One shows? I don't. PayPal donations, Audible signups, those are the two ways, other than listening to the show itself every single week. The two best ways that you can support the podcast. And I thank you for doing so. We'll be back next weekend with episode 332. So until then, be well, stay safe. We'll see you right back here next weekend for a brand new episode of the Solid Monster Sounds Off. Have yourselves a good week. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Solid Monster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
I beat the authority, and right now I stand here as the new WWE World Heavyweight Champion!
The bad.
Brock Lesnar into the cover, hooks the leg, the streak is over.
And the ugly.
Well, we are here with the new married couple.
Now we're tag team partners for life.
Sean and Marty said the same thing once upon a time.
Oh, I knew he was going to do that.
What a despicable act that was.
Oh, my God.
Well, mostly the good.
Solid Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007 on the SolidMonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Solid Monster Sound Off.